Welcome to the Brighton Book Club, a monthly show on Radio Reverb celebrating books and writing in Brighton and beyond. We are delighted to be partnering with the Coasters Queer Literature Festival to revisit some of their great events in the lead up to this year's festival, which will take place at ACCA at the Sussex University campus from the 10th to the 13th of October this year. The Coasters Queer is Brighton's annual festival of LGBTQ+ writing. The first of its kind in the UK, the festival creates a space for queer readers, writers and allies to come together in a grassroots celebration of the written word and its ability to illuminate and enrich the lives of our community. This is the third episode of the series and one of my absolute favourites, where we revisit Juno Dawson's lovely trans literary salon with the excellent Harry Nicholas talking about Harry's book, which was out last year, called A Trans Man Walks Into a Gay Bar. We hear extracts from Juno and Harry's new books and enjoy a lively conversation covering everything from writing sex to how good it feels to be endorsed by Elliot Page. And we ask the question, why are politicians still talking about trans people? Juno will be back with her fantastic salon on the Saturday of the festival with Kachenga Shenje talking about her new book, The Library Thief. You can find out more information, sign up to the newsletter and get tickets to the event over at coasterskweer.com. Make sure you're signed up to the mailing list and head over to the Coasters Queer website. Give them a follow on Instagram at Coasters Queer Fest for exclusive content and offers. And if you use the code PODCAST20 at checkout, you can get 20% off the price of event tickets. Enjoy!
It is my delight to introduce Juno Dawson. Juno is a number one Sunday Times bestselling novelist, screenwriter, journalist and columnist for Attitude magazine. Juno's books include the global bestsellers This Book Is Gay and Clean, and she won the 2020 Young Adult Book Prize for Meat Market. Her first adult fantasy trilogy, Her Majesty's Royal Coven, launched in 2022, becoming an instant bestseller, and she's just released the second book in the series to critical acclaim. She also writes for television and has multiple shows in development both in the UK and US. Her debut short film was The Birth of Venus, and she created the first official Doctor Who scripted podcast, Doctor Who Redacted. An occasional actress and model, Juno had a cameo in the BBC's I May Destroy You and a recurring role in Holby City, and was the face of a Jekka cosmetic play pots campaign. Important. Juno grew up in West Yorkshire, writing imaginary episodes of Doctor Who, and she later turned her talent to journalism, interviewing luminaries such as Steps and Atomic Kitten, before writing a weekly serial in a Brighton newspaper. Her writing has appeared in Glamour, The Pool, Dazed, and The Guardian, and she's appeared on Pointless Celebrities, BBC Woman's Hour, Front Row, ITV News, Channel 5 News, This Morning, and Newsnight. Juno lives in Brighton, and she's part of a queer cabaret collective known as Club Silencio. Check them out, they're amazing. In 2014, Juno became a school role model for the Stonewall, for charity Stonewall. Please welcome to the stage, Juno Dawson.
Hello. Hi. It's not just me tonight. I will be introducing Harry Nicholas very, very soon. But before we do, I'm just going to greet you to my lovely trans salon and the official launch of Coasters Queer. This is Juno Dawson's lovely trans salon. I think we've been doing this for about 6 years now. It's something that I love doing. It really was just an excuse for me to platform my friends. you don't get to be trans in the UK unless you release a book. It's part of the deal when they give you your hormones. And so it was just a nice excuse to get a chance. Back in the old days, we used to be at the Marlborough, which is now the Actors. And then we grew and we were invited to do the first When Coasters Queer before the pandemic with Juno Roche, which is still one of my very favourite events I think I've ever done. Down the years, we've had Travis Alabanza, we've had Kachenga, whose debut novel, The Library Thief, is coming out next year. And I think it's going to be really big for next year. So pre-order that now. We've had Chloe Filani, we've had Jay Graff, we've had Sean Fay. It's been such a treat, and long may it continue. And I love that we're back this year with Harry Nicholas. But before we get to Harry, I always like to take a small opportunity to plug my own books. Because if you can't plug yourself, how in the hell are you going to plug anybody else? We are now two-thirds of the way into the Her Majesty's Royal Coven trilogy. It's been really nice to be successful. I can't lie. I did wonder how many more book deals I was going to get, having sold about four books in my whole career. But luckily now I'm a number one bestseller, and Shadow Cabinet went Sunday Times bestseller as well, which means nobody can ever call me a one-hit wonder. So I've sort of transcended D-Ream, I guess. So that's good. I'm going to read a very, very short section. This is a literary salon, so it wouldn't be a salon without some readings. So I'm going to do a very short reading. It's fine if you haven't read Her Majesty's Royal Coven, but you do need to read Her Majesty's Royal Coven before the Shadow Cabinet, or it won't make a fucking lick of sense. But I'm just going to do a little titillating example. Can we start off with a wonderful round of applause for our interpreters, Sue and Marco, please? You don't have to do this next bit, but I was just saying to Harry backstage that back in the day when I was promoting This Book Is Gay, I used to read out a section which said the word Jake Gyllenhaal in it. It's not fair, is it? That's what they're... What sterling work our BSL interpreters do. Thank you so much, Sue and Marco. Right, OK, this is a little teeny tiny bit from The Shadow Cabinet, and we start in the prologue where we are with Miranda in a rainy cottage on the island of Inishmahan off the coast of Ireland. Biddy returned to the fireplace with her sewing kit, a tidy leather-bound case. You are with child. Twins, Miranda said. Biddy waited for her to continue. Something isn't right. It came out as a breathless sob, a mixture of unburdened, blessed relief and exasperation. They all say I'm mad. My husband, the doctors, my friends. They tell me to relax. They tell me the babies are fine, but I swear to Gaia, something is wrong. I just know it. A mother always does, Biddy said, opening her case. Lay by the fire, take off your blouse. The old woman rested a woolen blanket on the hearth, and Miranda did as instructed, neatly folding her soaked blouse on the chair. Will this hurt? No more than not knowing, Biddy said. Miranda lay flat on her back, looking up at the gaps in the thatched roof. With papery fingers, Biddy ran a gentle hand over her bump. How far gone? 4 months. Not too late, then, she said, and Miranda knew exactly what she meant. It wasn't just witches who sought Biddy's services. Women of all ages came from all over Ireland if they were in trouble. The Garda knew, no doubt, but wouldn't dare tackle Biddy Cleary. She found herself unable to look away as Biddy withdrew the longest sewing needle from the kit. Unlike anything else in the cottage, it gleamed. The witch held it over the flames a second, and then, with the speed of a far younger woman, pricked the flesh of her abdomen and removed it. It was all over in the blink of an eye. Biddy then lifted her veil, just enough for Miranda to see the taut, burned skin of her chin. With a pointed tongue, she licked the blood off the needle's tip. Miranda heard her breath falter, tremble. Biddy passed the needle through the flame again and struck once more. She repeated the tasting. And then she said nothing. Well? Miranda asked when she could bear the silence no longer. Biddy used the armchair to rise to her feet. Miranda too sat up. Tell me, what do you see? Biddy dropped her needle in a bowl of boiled water and set it aside. You will have twins, girls, identical in appearance. But you knew this. Yes. Miranda sat by the fire but was frozen, arms wrapped around her body. Are they healthy, though? Oh, yes, Biddy said without hesitation. Miranda clutched her stomach. Oh, bless the goddess, she breathed. Biddy Needle sat in her armchair. They will be as beautiful as they are powerful, both. Immensely so, adepts. Miranda's spirits lifted for a brief, glorious moment, the first second of peace in weeks. Perhaps Brendan was right, and she was simply a first-time mother, anxious and paranoid. In a year or so, she'd look back on this day and laugh, even telling her friends about her flit to Aaron. Only then Biddy went on. "But I'm very sorry to say, Miranda, beauty and power is all your daughters will have in common. For while one will be kind, generous and loving, the other will consort with devils." Miranda's eyes widened. "What?" "I'll say it plain. One will be good and the other evil." Thanks. Thank you. And if you've not had a chance to read Her Majesty's Royal Covenant yet, I would wholly recommend the audiobook version, which is read by Bridgerton and Derry girl Nicola Coughlan, and she does all the voices. So I did, you'll note, I didn't do Biddy's Irish accent. Nicola does all the voices. It's like, it's quite uncanny. I would recommend it. Anyway, no more messing around. Let's get to the salon part of the salon. I'm so excited about tonight. I thought I'd met Harry many, many times because we move in all the same circles, and it seemed to me just unthinkable that we had never met or worked together or done an event, but actually we haven't. Harry Nicholas is an amazing writer. He has written for, let me get this right, Huffington Post, Forbes, BBC Newsbeat, and was a part of the very, very wonderful BBC Three short film Things Not to Say to a Trans Person. He's also written for Pink News. His first book is the very, very brilliant A Trans Man Walks into a Gay Bar. This is what we're going to be talking about this evening. Please give me a rapturous round of applause for Harry Nicholas. Hiya.
You all right?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm all right, yeah.
Where have you come from today?
I live in London now, but I was about to say that it's nice to be at Juno's lovely northern trans salon as well.
It's a lovely slice of north in the south. Somebody the other day said to me, which do you think is best, being in the north or south? And I was like, I like being north in the south, which is, it's the best combo, I think.
Yeah, and it's the weather as well. I'll be fully northern, but like, you know, with the sun.
Yeah, it's kind of like, I would defend northerners to my death as long as I'm near a beach in the south.
And the Pretz.
So this is a Pret, a flower pot
there's
nearby.
Yeah, exactly.
Harry, could you please start us off with your little reading? Now, I understand you've been very nervous about your reading.
Yeah, I am, because like you write a book and you expect it to be read and then you have to go on a stage and read it and it's a bit nervous, isn't it?
Well, do you know what? It's exciting to be a primary school teacher. So I had to... Once you've read in character as a hungry caterpillar or such, everything else is quite steady, but not everybody has been a primary school teacher. But our audience here, I'm sensing just waves of loveliness coming from the audience. I think we are truly at a lovely trans salon and everybody is going to be very gentle and is very excited to hear you.
That's nice, thank you. I'm not going to be a massive caterpillar, but I'm going to talk about the first time that I went to a gay bar. Have you ever... No, you've never done that to young people.
Have I ever been to a gay bar?
No, I mean, have you ever talked about going to a gay bar? Okay, here we go. It was my first night out at the RVT as a gay boy, and I successfully pulled the hottest boy in there. It was the RVT's famous and long-established ducky night. I must admit, it's rare for me just to cock eyes an attractive man in the club and get off with him there and then. I don't want to paint myself as someone who's confident enough to do this regularly. I just think I got lucky. There was a drag artist who was performing a set about Twiggy. I looked up at the stage, my eyes glistening in my absolute element. A boy, maybe 3 or 4 metres to my left, was doing the same thing. We'd been making eyes at each other all night between getting drinks at the bar. His, a Camden Hells, mine, a double gin and tonic. It's always a double, by the way. He was tall, dark and handsome, not in a heterosexual James Bond kind of way. He was weedy looking and wore rounded tortoise shell glasses and hoop earrings with a sort of mullet at the back. He was a pretty boy and exactly my type. His brown eyes flared as the act made their exit and he turned to look at me, eyes catching and holding onto mine. I felt my body and face blush. I held my gaze back at him. I swallowed and gripped onto the red pillar next to me like a life raft. He moved closer, and as the DJ sat began, we danced together, our hips moving and chest pumping smooth as synth. He shouted in my ear in his luxurious Irish accent and asked for my name. Harry, I yelled, yours? His name got lost over the music, and truthfully, I probably wouldn't have remembered it anyway. I nodded in that polite way you do when you can't hear anything but pretend to know what the person's saying. We danced. The lights encouraged us, and so did the alcohol. Our lips pressed together, heads turning to get a closer touch, the stubble of our beards nuzzling each other. I could feel the gases pressing into my cheeks. My eyes closed and the world spanned as fast as the disco ball above. His tongue slid across mine, snaking around my mouth, his hands moving around my body, finally resting on my waist. I could feel his hips against mine and his hardening dick through my blue check trousers. I kissed him more, noticing how much my body longed for his. I told him I was trans on the dance floor, just before I asked him whether or not to come back to mine. I'm a trans man, I said, surprised at how confident and matter-of-fact I sounded. There was a time when that would have been the hardest thing in the world to say. There's a couple of beats between us where our shoulders shrugged with the music. That's cool, he said. I know already, I follow you on Twitter. Fucking hell. I know the gay community's small, but Christ, how much did he know about me? Still, I relaxed a little. I'd been dreading the inevitable awkward dance floor coming out. When's the right time? Before you kiss? You don't assume they want to get with you in the first place. Post-makeout? That feels too late. In the cab? Well, that feels too dangerous. I'm literally on the way to the house and there's no getting out on the Wembley bypass. Just before sex? Well, I didn't want to get too much myself in a vulnerable position. It's not fair that we have to constantly out ourselves like this. I suppose cisgender people don't have to. It's that cis until proven otherwise thing again, isn't it? Even queer and gay people who are educated and welcoming and knowledgeable about trans people still assume cis until proven otherwise, unless they follow you on Twitter. It was a mixture of excitement and nervousness as we got the cab back to West London. Neither of us said much. Instead, we held hands hidden away from the driver in the dark, taking what opportunity we had to continue the intimacy from the dance floor. We stroked each other's fingers, the confirmation that we both needed that this, whatever it was still happening. I hadn't had sex with a guy before. Well, not properly anyway. Gone soft now in a tent quite counts. My stomach filled with anxiety and I worried. I worried if my body would work. I worried if it would hurt. I worried about his size, if he was really big or if he was really small, or if the condoms I had were in date, or if he'd agreed to use one anyway, or if he couldn't come, or if I would enjoy it, or if he'd ever been with someone with a pussy before, or all this was completely new to him too. I worried if I'd remembered to make my bed, and if there's anything in for breakfast, and what was his name again? I turned to face him. He'd fallen asleep, his hand in mine and his head gently rocking on the headrest. Streetlights flashed through the window as the cab twisted through the silent residential streets. We got out the car, thanked the driver who shot me a knowing look as I fumbled in my pocket. We made our way to the flat, and I turned my key in the front door. Thank you very much.
Thank you. See, that wasn't so bad. There we go. Well done. You've got. I'm going to read a bit from your book later, but I'm not going to ask you to do any more readings. You're free. You're safe now. How are you finding it? How has it been? When did the book come out? Was it earlier this year?
Yeah, May.
May. How has it been? Now it's in the world.
Yeah, it's a slightly different thing, isn't it? Because when you write it, you've kind of got it in your head about what it's going to be, and then people read it, and you're like, fuck, I never actually thought anyone would actually read this thing. And it's been interesting because some people take bits from it that surprises me, things that they relate to that I didn't necessarily, that I thought maybe were just me. So that's been nice to see that it's done that. And it's a long process, as you know, to write and then have the worrying about it coming out and then the worry about the reviews and if they're good and if they're bad. So it's been nice. Thankfully, it's been... yeah, a nice journey so far.
Yeah. So in general, and I'm going to posit this question to our audience as well. How are you? It's the Holly Willoughby question, isn't it? First of all, how are you? I felt very lucky to be in Gran Canaria last week on the day that the Prime Minister went full fash. Perhaps not surprising, but still really hard to hear. Obviously, I'm not surprised by anything the government says anymore, but I still found, even from the distance of Gran Canaria, I still found it really hard to hear coming from his mouth. And I know this is the lovely Trans Salon where we are in a very safe space, but how are you finding the UK right now? Where should we go live, Harry, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, is Gran Canaria nice?
Gran Canaria is lovely. Right. Do you know what? We could go there, actually. It'd be nice.
It's got quite a big gay scene, so maybe
massive
we could
down Yumba.
Up.
Have you never been to Yumba Centre?
No.
Sorted. Let's go.
That's next year. Yeah. Yeah, it's bloody hard at the minute, isn't it? I mean, I'm kind of with you in that I'm not really surprised, and yet I'm constantly surprised. I think for the last few years, maybe 5 years ago, it kind of felt like these groups of people were sort of on the fringes. They were making a noise, but it didn't really feel like it was going to be, you know, the Prime Minister having transphobic rhetoric, and then there it was. Yeah, it's been a really difficult couple of weeks, and it felt like what was waiting for the Sunday papers at one point, you know, rolling around what's going to be the transphobic headline this week, it's now what's going to be happening today. So it's difficult at the moment, for sure. And I, you know, have a day job as well as my writing, and you hear all this stuff on the news, and then it's like, oh, well, I've now got to go into a meeting, or I've now got to go for dinner and act like I'm fine, even though I'm not sure if I completely am, and I'm not quite sure what to do about it. So I fear for me, and I fear for my trans friends, but we've got to keep going. I think ultimately I'm an optimistic person. I'm hopeful that we'll absolutely fucking smash this government and get the Tories out, hopefully.
Yeah, thank you. Do you know what? Last night was really interesting. So I was in a room with all the great and good of the LGBTQ-ness of London last night, of celebs, but also like people in industry, because they sell tables. So there's lots of companies. And the guy who owns Attitude Magazine is a card-carrying conservative, boo. And Darren and I we've had, because I adore him, and it is sometimes possible to be friends with Tories. It's not easy, but...
That's the headline. Right? Yeah.
So Darren and I have talked, and his whole thing going back, and he did lots of work with Theresa May, was... that's my favourite. Do you want to hear my favourite joke?
I'd love to.
Who's going to make the Christmas dinner in 10 Downing Street?
I don't know who's going to make the Christmas dinner in 10 Downing Street.
Theresa May.
Oh.
But anyway, so when Theresa May was in power, Darren's whole thing was, I think it's really important that we work with the government because they're in power and this is the only way we'll see change. I thought that was incredibly naive and told him so. But things have changed. So just in the space of however many, obviously there's been like five prime ministers or whatever since then, but Darren gave the most fiery speech of the night about how they don't get any more chances, that they don't get the benefit of the doubt anymore. And the reception in the room was so furious. Every single person, gay, straight, trans, bi, everyone there got up on stage and gave a little shout out to the trans community, from Shirley Bassey to Louise from Eternal, to, you know, everybody was saying the same thing. And I really think they're fucked. And I'm actually a pessimist, actually. So I think talking about trans people is the final nail in their coffin. Because my mum is such a useful barometer. She still lives near Bradford. And even she's like, why are they talking about trans women? Like, my mortgage has gone up about five times. You know, why I can't afford to put my heating on. Why are they talking about trans people? And I think that's the consensus. And so I think actually these insane final death knells of this government, what's fucked them? I think people want a bit of hope, not hate. People just want to know that their mortgage is going to come back down.
Yeah, I think there's definitely something that my parents, well, I think confuse politics and economics sometimes, and they have definitely voted Tory in the past, and it's been, you know, the amount of topics that we've had where I've like nearly walked out of like Sunday lunch because I just can't have that conversation with them. And then my mum texted me the day saying, can't believe he said that. Anyway, what am I getting Liam for his birthday? My partner. And it was just about like for her to say like and recognize that it was a bad thing was actually a massive thing for her. And I think I really hope that people are starting to see actually the veil unlift.
Yeah, I mean, I have, and actually Darren very fairly pointed out, we have to, if we are to assume that the next government is going to be a Labour government, there are some quite concerning figures within the Labour Party as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I think, interestingly, at this point, of course, the Tories are going to be absolutely rank, but so maybe now we almost preempt what's going to happen next, which is there are some figures, including in Brighton. There's a councillor in Brighton. So there's a petition going around at the moment about a Labour councillor in Brighton and Hove who is not very kind to trans people. So yes, so I think that's maybe the next, maybe we look ahead to that. But anyway, let's move on. I just wanted to make sure you're right. Audience, are you all right as well? But this is weird. This is my Pollyanna moment. Do you know what I realised? Like, they can't stop you being trans. And I find weird comfort in that. They can try. They can make it really, really hard. They can fuck with our meds. They can take away my passport and my driver's license and my birth certificate. They can fuck with all of those things. And I would still be me. And then I sort of think back to all those, the people who came before us, you know, the April Ashleys and Christine Jorgensen-Stones and all those people. They didn't have passports or, you know, gender recognition certificates, and they still got to be men or women. They can't stop us being us. Whatever they say, whatever they do. That said, I would really like my medication. So if we can, I would really like things to get better, not worse. Anyway, enough of that darkness. Elliot Page really liked your book.
I know.
Did a bit of poo come out?
Fucking
yeah.
Mad.
Did you know that was going to happen?
No. Not clear.
Like, did all of a sudden did your phone start going mad?
I was asleep. Like, I go to bed ridiculously early. I love a nap. I love to be like, it's my favorite. You know, in Barbie, it's like his job is beach, my job is bed. Like, I fucking love being in bed. And so I was asleep and I woke up in the morning to a ridiculous number of notifications and I was like, who died? Like, what's happened? Like, what have I done? Like, everything. And it was just really, really kind. He's such an absolute gem for doing that. I mean, that's what I kind of really like about our community sometimes, that we lift each other up and we support each other. And he absolutely didn't have to do that. I never sent him the book. He, you know, he bought it and read it on his own accord. And he's an absolute sweetheart for using his platform for that. So I know he's done that for other authors as well.
He's not done it for me, Harry.
I'll put in a word.
Yeah, thanks. But,
do you know what's wild about it is that like two people that morning as well was like, oh, do you think Elliot might want to come on my like podcast? I'm thinking about doing. And I was like, we're not friends, right?
But how did he get the book? Did he just buy it?
Yeah, apparently he bought it in Gaze the Word, which I just find mental.
That's how it should work. That's the story that you want to happen.
It just never happens. I feel so blessed that he did that.
Then that is good, because I think there was that sort of scarcity complex back in the day where in the British media there could only be one trans person and we were slightly pitted against each other. And it's pleasing to see that. I think that has now died to death. And that was one of the things I wanted to do with the salon in the first place anyway, which was, you know, there can be more than one. It's not the Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
There's an open spot in this morning now if you want to take it.
How are you? God, can you imagine me and Alison Hammond? That would be, maybe that's the future. That is the future.
I'd
Liberals
pay for that.
One. Yeah. But we'll see. But no, that was amazing. And if Elliot Page would like to read my book next, that would be
I'll put it on his list.
Thanks. Yeah, just in the comments. Now I'm going to go to my questions now because I want to ask them in the correct order because one does walk into the next. Brilliant. Okay. So this is, and I've asked this question before, and I've been asked this question before as somebody who wrote a memoir / book of essays. So when I wrote Gender Games, I wanted it to be a book of essays. The publisher wanted it to be memoir. Was there a similar tug of war with you, or was this how you always envisaged the book?
That's a really good question, actually. And no, I don't think there was. I'm very grateful to have a publisher who kind of sent his own voices and helped me, you know, position it and structure it right. But it was never, that was always what the book was going to be. And so they went, well, yes, we'll take that and help me sort of change it. But it was always designed to be what it is now. I kind of learned a lot along the way, but it never was changed for commercial reasons. Mm-hmm. I think there was a slight worry about memoir being, you know, sort of a trodden path.
Yeah.
But this, I think, was doing something slightly different in that it wasn't a before and after, and then at the end of it, I transition, everything's happy. It kind of starts at the end or the middle of my transition. And then sort of, so it's like doing something slightly different, I think. And I'm very lucky that my publisher kind of let me do what I wanted and then submitted it and then went, great, we'll just restructure that and make it better.
If you've not read the book yet, it's so readable, and that is, I think, a fantastic compliment.
Thank you.
It's sort of structured in a way of Harry presents a story from his life and then reflects it back to sort of the social or political kind of context which we can derive from that story. So it's what I hoped to achieve with Gender Games as well, which is polemic mixed with storytelling and narrative. It's very friendly, it's very funny, I would say as well, which is wonderful.
Now, my ex-girlfriend, who's now a stand-up comic, is absolutely fuming about that people have said it's funny.
Cause she, why?
Because she always wanted to be the funny one.
Oh.
And now everyone's like, why are you getting this?
Well, maybe she should fucking transition as well. Because then she would get her book deal with her hormones. But you said that memoir is a well-trodden path, and it absolutely is. But do you think we have to do memoir, because otherwise we kind of risk falling into the trap of generalizing our personal experience to all trans people, which I think I've been guilty of at times as well.
Yeah, I agree. And also, you know, what was nice about writing this book, I was saying that this is my experience, it is not the experience. Just because there's not really that much out there doesn't mean that, you know, one person is, you know, we're not a homogenous group. And so that was nice to be able to do. And I find that the memoirs that I have read, we spoke about Juno Roche a little bit earlier in the dressing room, and I found myself in so much of what she wrote. I actually don't think I would have had the courage to write some of the stuff in this book that if she hadn't gone before me and I'd sort of related to it, especially the stuff about existing outside of boxes or, you know, borders that of gender, of the constraints that people put on us in terms of gender. And Travis Alabanza's None of the Above as well, which is kind of memoir-ish, but in terms of essays and things that I've said to them. So I find a lot of value in them, even though they're quite different experiences to me. I've learned a lot about myself and understanding of myself through them. So I think there is real value in those. And I don't think we're at a point yet where it's like, no, we don't need any more. I think absolutely we should be putting out new voices all the time. And if memoir is a way that people can do that and share their experiences of all kinds of different intersections as well, then absolutely we should be publishing more of it.
Yeah, and I think as well that there is a different kind of power as well in just existing, especially right now. And I think even if your experience doesn't exactly align with another trans person, there's a kind of wholesome reassurance in just knowing there's other trans people in the world. I still think we're at that stage in our collective trauma as a community that it's just nice to know we're not alone anymore. I still take strength from that.
And I still think there are things that are unsaid. You know, I've done a couple of these talks now where people said, oh, well, you know, there's power in being trans and then not being talking about being trans. And I think, well, yes, but also I like talking about it. It's a massive part of my life. And the reason why I write so much about sex in the book is because I wasn't reading anything about trans people having great sex, or wasn't reading about trans people needing to go and get like Plan B from the pharmacy. I'd never read or really like heard about people talking about that before. So there's still stuff that needs to be explored, I think.
And that is such an amazing segue. Harry has seen my questions. Did you plan that?
I didn't plan it, but I had a feeling that it might go down that
route. What an amazing segue. let's talk about how horny you are. This is, without any doubt, a horny book. Let's just call it what it is. It's a horny book. Testosterone. Let's discuss testosterone. It's quite powerful, isn't it?
It is. Yes. Fucking hell. Yeah, it is. And I'm a little bit annoyed at the moment because I'm on sertraline, which just squishes all of that down.
Oh,
what a bummer. But yeah, it's it is powerful, as is estrogen. And I don't know whether actually, I mean, there is the kind of myth of trans guys or non-binary people when they start testosterone that becomes super horny. And I think there's probably something in that. But also, is it just that we're excited and more comfortable in our bodies? Is it that we're excited that we're starting to see ourselves as we sort of exist in our head? And I think there's something to be said for that and wanting to explore yourself as well. But I think I've always just been a bit horny, to be honest. Right.
Well, that's reassuring, isn't it? You bring your baggage with you, as Patrick Strudwick once said. It goes on the journey with you. I thought, actually, now this, I'm not flirting with you, I'm married, but I thought you wrote about sex really well. Like, ooh, it's thanks. Arousing. Would you consider writing porn, is what I'm saying?
Yes.
Oh my, you heard it here first, exclusive, because it's queer.
No, there is, I had to be serious for a second, I think it's really important to be talking about sex. It's a big part of a lot of our lives. And for some reason, trans people have been excluded from that conversation, which is the reason why I was, you know, it was non-negotiable, it was going to be in there. I remember going on the set of Transparent for whatever reason, like, you know, 5-6 years ago, and going, where's the sex scenes between these people? And they're going, oh yeah, we haven't seen that before. I did my dissertation in, I was working in film and studying it, and I did my dissertation on like violence and like sexual depiction in film, and it was all sexual assault pretty much that you know, sex was being depicted as. And that's just not the truth of our lives. We have so much happy, fulfilling, explorative sex. So I was really excited to be able to explore that. And I did really enjoy writing those parts as well. I think there's probably my favourite bits to write about in the book was the bits where I was enjoying myself, or the bits that I found challenging and bits that were revealing for myself as well. They were also the most difficult bits to write, in that they also had confidentiality things in terms of getting people to sign
did you
waivers.
Have to do the bit? Yeah. Mm.
Which is always the worst bit of nonfiction and memoir, is that these are actual people who do not want the call of, hey, I'm writing a book and you're in it. That is not a call that anybody wants, least of all my ex-girlfriend. So, I would enjoy writing something that didn't necessarily require that, where we could...
you write fiction?
Yeah, I'd love to. And actually, I mean, you've gone from writing non-fiction to fiction. How have you found that?
Well, I flip-flop. So I went fiction, non-fiction, and then have sort of gone back and forth. But I like it. Nonfiction is like a palate cleanser. You lose yourself in fiction. It's you're spending time with made up people in your head.
Yeah, and I think there is something about potentially being more truthful in fiction sometimes as well.
I will say that. I think I've revealed as much about myself in my novels as I have in my nonfiction.
Yeah, and that's fun. And also, you know, speaking to people about writing a book and you're writing about being trans and gay and sex and stuff, people don't want to have sex with you, funnily enough, when you're when you're doing that, because they think they're going to be in the book. And now that it's out, suddenly, yeah.
Did you have to remember the guy's name to get clearance to use that scene?
No comment.
Yeah. Do you know what? I bet if we had long enough, I think having somebody who frequented Push the Button and Ducky a lot from 2010 to 2015, I bet we could probably work out who it was. Just probably elicits the same faces.
This is what we're going to do for the next half an hour. Just go through.
Is it him from Stonewall? Is it him? No, we're not going to do that, I promise. You also talk about sort of, I don't really know how to say, I'm quite tired, the dark side of sexiness, when it's, and this, I think this is a bit that most resonated with me, and again, it's a bit that thing about finding yourself in someone else's memoir, was that bit when it was the lost weekends on Grindr, the aimless, just sort of looking for something in a hookup to sort of fill a hole.
Physically and metaphorically.
Yeah, and sort of like trying to fill the metaphorical hole physically, kind of. And then also the delight, the giddy nostalgia I felt when you arrived at Pleasure Drome. If you're not aware in the audience, can you explain what Pleasure Drome is, please? I'm going to say, is it Pleasure Dome or Pleasure Drome?
I think it's Pleasure Drome.
Pleasure Drome. You're like Tina Turner, welcome to the Pleasure Drome. That's Thunder Drome. They're different. Tina Turner did not go to Pleasure Drome.
I would have loved to have seen that. Yeah, Pleasure Drome is a gay bathhouse, a sauna underneath. I think it's Waterloo. I ended up on a bus going in that direction and thought, why not? It was actually around Halloween as well, so it's like ridiculously expensive to get a taxi, and thought, well, you know, I'll give it a try. People have said stuff about this. I went in and everyone was asleep. I was like, I thought this was meant to be like a really sexy, fun place. Like, the news is playing on there. Everyone's asleep, like...
Like that's G for you. Don't do G, kids.
So I was a bit disappointed my first time there, really. Sort of walked around thinking, oh, yeah, it's a bit horrible. But I just... I was frightened. I was actually frightened. I'll be honest about that. I was... You go in and I had no idea sort of what the etiquette was. I think that's also the same for like gay bars. You go in for the first time and you're like, oh, I don't really know what to do, how to behave, how to act. And it was the same in the sauna, because he handed this towel and I was like, oh God, I wore my underwear underneath and I was pretty sure, like, oh God, it just seems ridiculous doing that. And yeah, just ended up watching the news and then went home in the tube.
In the book, that seems electric. And I think, I will say this, it really, really helped that this is going to blow your mind. I was born a boy. And there was a time when I lived in London that I too, weirdly, through a very strange, convoluted journey, found myself in Pleasure Drome after a night out with a friend. And by this point, I was well into my 30s. And, no, hang on, is that right? Yeah, early 30s, late 20s. And my friend that I was with in the Two Brewers could not believe that I had never set foot in a sauna, because I had a similar sort of misconception of what it was going to be. I thought it was going to be something terribly sort of seedy and a bit like sort of that night... What's the film called? The Al Pacino one, Cruising, or is it Night Hunters or something? That one. And so I thought it was going to be really scary. And so my friend, who I've very nearly named... My friend sort of dragged me to Pleasure Drome in Waterloo Arches, and it was like Xanadu. It's horrible because it's like fake Greek shit everywhere. So there's like fake columns. So it's a bit like an aqua park.
It's like, where's the slides?
Yeah, it's like an aqua park without the slides. But instead of slides, there's like a sad jacuzzi. And like some little saunas and stuff.
And it's always so awkward as well when someone's like, oh yeah, the bubbles have stopped. And people just like shuffle along.
Somebody's got to press the button.
It's like people in there are still guys that don't really want to go around each other. Like, you know, it's just, it's odd. It's a really strange place.
But it's kind of, I quite like the sort of the dynasty factor. But then you do go upstairs and in your book it's so electric, because upstairs is a very different vibe, and you know, you can smell it before you see it, and there's all like these little kind of little doors where you go into them and have sex on like a PE mat.
It is a PE mat.
And you're having sex on a PE mat.
And then you're lying there like this, and then you just see two eyes like this looking in. It's wild.
Cursed. Yeah, it's... But I know that I've had both the best and worst night of my life, I think. And it was interesting. And so, again, this is where I saw the parallel. So that first night, which was a busy Saturday night, it was like the last days of Rome. Then I'd had so much fun that night that I took myself back on a rainy Wednesday. And it was like, you know the scene, you know the film Bedazzled with Elizabeth Hurley, where Brendan Fraser goes back to hell and all the people are still dancing even though they don't want to be dancing.
That's always the mistake.
Yeah, it was kind of like, I should have left this party. It was awful. I did a lap, realised what has become of your life, left and transitioned. No, that's not true. I left, and it was when I was still eating meat. I left and got chicken McNuggets and ate them on the train back to Clapham.
What I find the most interesting, it isn't necessarily like the sex that goes on in there, or like, you know, how people are sort of communicating without any language. Like, all of that I find fascinating. And for me, believe it or not, it wasn't about going there and having sex, really. It was about being in that space. It felt like a rite of passage to be a gay man. That is not true, but I felt like there was something that was pulling me there for some reason to just experience that space. But much of the book is about experienced spaces, actually. And I went to... I've just lost my trail of thought completely.
Sorry, that's me.
That's my ADHD brain, sorry. I'll remember it in a second, I'm sure.
I'm really mindful that we're running out of time and I want to get some audience Q&A in, so I'm just going to pick one more of my questions and psychically send my other questions to the audience. So hopefully they'll ask the ones that I have not had time to ask. The one I think I would like to ask most is... Oh, no, because they're all really good questions.
I'm doing like a bet in my head about which one it is.
Oh... I can't believe we've just spent 20 minutes talking about gay saunas. Let's talk about the... I think this one is the most important one. Because so much of the book, actually... I mean, something... The other questions are really good, and I might prompt some people. But it's about... This book is also a bit of a memoir of body and what makes a person. Is it body... Is it mind? Is it soul? And how you have come to renegotiate you in your terms and your relationship with your body. When you started to write this book, did you know? Because I think that's the biggest theme of this book, actually. Did you know that was going to be really kind of the heart of this book?
No, I didn't really. And some of the book... actually, I wrote as I was experiencing things as well. So there's a chapter in there about wearing a jockstrap for the first time. And that wasn't actually, in terms of the timeline of the book, I was experiencing that as I was writing it. And I kind of felt, I had this anticipation of how I would feel putting on a jockstrap and feeling a lack of bulge in my pants or feeling like I was lacking something to be a gay man, because so much about being gay seemingly is about bodies and having the perfect body. And I think a lot of men would relate to not feeling like man enough because of their bodies. And so I learned a lot about myself in that process, actually. I didn't feel like I was lacking. I kind of realized the first time, really, that I was molding myself into... Like, I'm deliberately making myself a better person. Whereas, you know, the gender criticals might say that I've, you know, done whatever to myself and I've ruined my body, I actually think I've become myself. And that's amazing that you've been able to sculpt someone that you think is you. And that was a really exciting thing to explore, I think, and something that I've carried with me since. I don't often say that writing is like restorative in some way. Actually, it can be quite traumatizing sometimes to pull up some of the stuff. But those were the moments actually about relating to myself and my body and feeling comfortable in it that I really enjoyed to pick out.
And I think it's something that happens. I mean, I think we've been transitioning for roughly the same amount of time. And I think it's always really fascinating. And that's why I do think, I don't want to be shady about any people, but about the importance of why we put so much spotlight on people who have very recently come out. Like, there's a huge thing, you know, because everybody loves the makeover moment, that the people who are handed a microphone are often people who have been on the journey, on the process of especially medical transition for a matter of weeks. Tell me about being trans. And I think actually there is something really valuable about hearing from a man who has had ups and downs and kind of had different beliefs about themselves and their body over time, as have I. And I think, you know, I think now perhaps I wrote The Gender Games too soon. I think I was asked to write it, and of course I bit their hand off because I was a writer who needs money. But actually, when I look back at The Gender Games now, I think it works really well as a portrait of a desperately lost and confused trans baby.
It's interesting you say that, because I think if I wrote this like even a couple of years before I did, actually my approach would have been completely different. And I, at that time, I know people who, you know, can't dare to say the names of their genitalia because it's too difficult for them. And I'm like, I love my pussy. Like, I can hold those two things at the same time. I can kind of struggle with my image and my hips and feel like I want to tear them off. But at the same time, I can love other parts of my body and the pleasure that it gives me. And to be able to know that you can have both of those things. Actually, they both coexist rather than just being purely one or purely the other. That is the kind of nuance that I like. And that was a comfort, actually, to go, I don't have to fit into anything. I don't have to solely hate my body. I don't have to wholly enjoy it either. I can exist as both. It's like, yeah, the light and the shade. And Travis Alabanza actually put this best in terms of how queer people are really good at doing that, in terms of we have depth and we also have height, and that range makes us really powerful. I've definitely taken that as a sort of inspiration. Mm.
Speaking of joy, is this a wedding ring?
It's an engagement ring.
Round of applause. Thank you. So that's new. That's not in the book. Let's end on some trans joy. One of my questions was going to be about the importance of trans joy. So please tell us the story. Did it come in a little cake or something?
It didn't, but I'd been asking for this for a long time. When's it going to come? I was very, very excited. So my partner Liam proposed to me in Cyprus, and it was the most beautiful thing ever. And my friends were involved in planning it all and everything. There is real trans joy. And I thought actually joy would come from other people accepting me. And actually what I found through the pandemic actually was that there are moments of joy between the shit that I really, really like. And spending time with my partner Liam is one of my favorite things in the world. Even if it's just like a walk to the shops, it just makes me so happy. So that's definitely something brilliant that's come out.
Oh, I think, that's a lovely spot for us to end on. Now we're going to turn to our audience. Some ground rules: make sure the question has a question mark in it. And to ask a question, it should be one or two sentences, and one of those sentences should have a question mark. You've all been to those events. I would just like to tell you about my book. No! So we're not going to do that. So we're going to have a question. And remember, this is my lovely trans salon. So we're going to stick to lovely questions. Less than lovely questions might be asked to leave the room. So there we go. So let's see if we've got any questions for Harry. Big old hands up, please. And there we'll go. We've got one here. Please wait for the microphone in case anybody is a bit hard of hearing. Thank you very much. Oh, it's not alive. Give it a bop. Oh.
Yeah, we can hear that, I think.
Hi. Hello. Oh, you're recording it. Hi. Thank you so much, both of you. It's fantastic. I'm from a small publishing company, and I'm here on my own, and it was great to hear you. Harry, how did you go from the seeming promiscuity of finding yourself in the Pleasure Dome sauna, not that I know where that is, of course, I live around the corner from it, to finding the one who proposed to you? How did that happen?
Simultaneously, actually.
And congratulations, by the way.
In a sauna. I don't think it's wrong of me to say that we have an open relationship and we're able to explore other... Sorry, Liam, out in the open. But yeah, I think that's kind of the joy of being gays, that we have different types of relationships all the time, and we respect each other a lot and trust each other a lot, and he knows that there are parts of me that I have yet to explore, and I haven't been a man for that long, and I would like to, explore my sort of newfound masculinity and body and stuff. So, yeah, it was... the two can coexist. I can go home and have a lovely lasagna with my gorgeous fiancé, and I can also be really horny
on a rainy Wednesday night at Pleasure Dome. But the origin story of you and Liam is in the book, isn't it? So where did you originally first meet him?
So he rejected a couple of dates that I asked him on because he had better offers. And then, the pandemic happened and we started speaking online quite a lot. And we kind of did it backwards in that we found out so much about each other before we'd even met. It kind of felt like those old school sort of love letters, which I actually really treasure, because we've got them in sort of voice note form, and very occasionally I'll go back to them and listen to those very, very early days. It's very special. And then when we came out of the pandemic, our first date was going to and playing tennis together because it was like one of the only things you could do.
Something 2 meters apart, yeah.
Yeah, so it kind of grew from there. And we, when we entered the second lockdown, we decided I'd rather spend, we don't know when this is going to end, and I'd rather spend time with you than not. So I kind of moved in and that was it, yeah.
I was really weird because a lot of lockdown couples lasted for as long as lockdown. So when I was reading the book, I was like, oh, I know where this one's going. And then we met and hated each other. So, but no, like, luckily that did not happen. Anymore. I've not got my glasses on, so really stick your hand up. Oh, there we go. There's somebody here. Thank you. I was going to say, I've got two backup questions if it all goes wrong. So fear not.
Thank you, Juno and Harry. I'm Vedrana from Brighton University. First sentence, over 60 undergraduate students have read your book. I think that opening that you just read, Harry, and absolutely loved it. Question, when it comes to trans story, what future direction of the memoir would you like to see?
When
it comes to telling trans stories, what future direction for the memoir would you like to see as a genre?
Ooh, that's a good one.
Yeah, I think that is. I would like to see more representation of intersections, whether that's like between gender and sexuality. That's an area that I'm particularly interested in because, for some reason, in like, you know, lessons, it's like gender is this, and then sexuality is this, and then they're all completely separate. For me, I'm like they've intertwined and mixed, and they're complicated and nuanced. And I don't think it's as simple as with this and this. I would like to see more intersections of people of color, of course. There's a dearth of literature on that, trans people of color. I think just more stories from like migrants and people who are disabled, like everything we have. For whatever reason, centered a lot of whiteness, actually. And I'd like to see other stories that have been told.
Thank you. Any more for any more? I don't think that's enough. Oh, there's one. Thank you. Hello. That is one. That's assertively an arm. Thank you.
Hi, Harry. Has your mum read the book? And if so, did you discuss it afterwards?
That was my question. Thank you. So this person, what's your name? Say, what's your name?
Mitchie.
This person is psychic. Well done, you. So you've learned something about yourself tonight as well. See, so that was my question as well about your lovely family. So tell us about your lovely family.
Yeah, it's a very good question. Yes, she has read it. She was dying to get her hands on the manuscript, and I was thinking, well, we might have to wait a bit longer. Yeah, it was difficult. I had to have a bit of a conversation with her and say, these are some conversations. I'm not writing this book for you, mother. You know, this is not something that I would necessarily choose to tell you over sit down with a cup of tea. But I think these are important conversations to be had. And I think I am as good as another person to do that. And bless her, she's been through quite a lot. And she, she's very, very supportive. She wasn't at first necessarily. We struggled for a little bit, but she respects me, and I think she realised that this book was more than just our relationship. It had bigger meaning beyond that, and I don't think she's felt very comfortable reading some of it, but I think she understands that it's important, and therefore, yeah, definitely supportive of it.
Because that's an amazing bit in the book. The coming out story is really lovely, and I still think coming out stories, I know, again, it's a very well-trodden path, but I think they're so important because people are still coming out. That was really touching, your mum's response versus your dad's response. Has there been, since the book came out, has some very unexpected person given you hassle? That's what, there should be a pre-memoir warning, which is a person you have not thought about is going to kick off.
See, this is the problem about being from a small town in the north, is that you'll meet the person that you least expect in Tesco, packing the bags, and you'll give the eyes to each other and never say a word, even though you went to school with them for years or whatever. The best thing about transitioning is that they don't really recognise who you are anymore.
Witness protection, yeah.
That's my favourite thing, because they don't know. So no, I don't think I've really encountered that, but I'm not exactly quiet about being trans. There's been a couple of people from school that I've had to be like, I wouldn't have necessarily wanted you to have followed me, but here we are. So I've not really encountered anything, thank God.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
What did my mum? Oh, this. Sorry, mum, if you'd worried my mum be here. But my mum took a. So This was a book in which I speak graphically about having sex in a toilet in Dublin, and she took offence at the fact I revealed I lived in a council house. She was like, did you have to tell people we lived in a council house?
Do you know what? That's so mad, because it was a similar thing to when I was so nervous about... So the question that my mum posed to me when I first came out was, who's going to love you? And I thought that was a really difficult thing to have said. I thought actually that might be a point of contention. And she said, why have you written about you living in a rural village? I was like, so it's a yes then, so we can go ahead.
Well, is it not a rural village?
But it is. But I think she thought, she's like, oh, we're on the outskirts of Manchester. And I'm like, it's a rural village. so yeah, it was just crazy things that they pick up on. Or maybe they just don't want to like interact with the difficult bits. But my mum, bless her, I mean, you have to sort of, you know, she'll put anything on Facebook. So she'd love to have been here and taken pictures or whatever. But I'd kind of have to say, sometimes it's appropriate, sometimes it's not.
We'll do Manchester Festival especially and invite your mum to chair the event. Any more last questions before we all go get another McDonald's? Or something less morally bankrupt? Any more? Well done, everyone. Ah, oh, there we go. Right, so close. This will be the last one, though, so make it a nice one to finish on. Thank you. Hiya,
I'm Mally. I was just wondering, what would you say to queer writers who are just starting out and like how to kind of get to where you are? Yeah?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that question might be better for you, Juno. I think there are quite a lot of talent scouts out at the moment, I think, looking particularly for queer literature. I think quite a few more than there were a couple of years ago, I would have said. Maybe because they think it's very commercially successful.
It isn't always. Steady.
In terms of advice, I think you've got to write what's true to you and what you want to write. I think some people will come to you with an idea, potentially, and it might fit with you, it might not. But if it's true and it's real, and then you submit it to an agent or you submit it to a publisher, you know, ask for very genuine feedback on that, but don't let it lead you down a path that you don't necessarily want to go down. There were some hard lines for me in this book, and thankfully I didn't need to, including sex, for example, and thankfully I didn't need to really do much about that. But it depends on what you want to write. But I think there's quite a lot of opportunity at the moment to be writing stuff, and absolutely, yeah, go for it. Don't hold yourself back because you think that what you're saying is not of value or that there's another one out there or whatever. Like, just absolutely go for it.
I think that's right. I think now is the most exciting time there has been for queer writers. I think across the board, the publishing industry, which is far from perfect, I want to see much more representation on the other side of the desk. And I've said elsewhere that with the exception of the American editor on Her Majesty's Royal Cover and a woman called Nidhi Pigalia, all my UK editors have been white women, well-meaning white women, but all white women. But I do think there is at least there's some well-meaning there, which is better than when I started in the industry where there were people saying, you don't want to pigeonhole yourself, kind of. So I think it is the most exciting time I've seen for queer writers. But the first thing, and I think you're absolutely right, is to just write the book you want to write or write what it is you want to write. And almost block out the noise. Because there are a lot of queer writers writing now. But only you are going to sound like you. Nobody else in the world is going to sound like you. So just be you.
And what I would say as well is ask, your queer friends and other queer authors for help. Like, don't be shy to reach out to them, because I found them to be the most welcoming and giving the best advice and, yeah, uplifting people you possibly can. They're not so far away. So do reach out for them as well.
Thank you. So that brings me to my last point, which is, Harry, what's next? Are you doing more writing?
I don't know why
the lights are going out.
Get off the stage.
We get it. We're all hungry, all right?
I'm not at the minute. I'm planning my wedding, which is a joy and a big task. And I want to, I mean, I'm still doing like book tour stuff, and you'll know how exhausting that is. And I'm just wanting to live. Oh, there we go. I'm just wanting to live life for a bit, because I don't think you can be creative if you've not got any like battery inside you, and I've not got anything completely new to say yet. I do have ideas and things that I want to write, fiction for
write
sure.
A novel.
Yeah, I'd
sex
love to.
Novel.
I'd love to write like a. I'd love to write a Brontes Parnell kind of like 100 boyfriends transmasculine version. Like I'd love to write that. But I think I don't really want to get into the. You write a book and churn it out every year because I think it's exhausting and it's yeah. I want it to be the right time. So yeah, living life and getting inspiration just now.
Yay. Well, thank you so much for coming down to Brighton to see us at Cursed is Queer. Thank you for launching Cursed is Queer.
Thank you for having me.
Big round of applause for Harry. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh. Thank you for coming out. I think if you were to leave now, you will still be home in time for Drag Race on BBC Three.
Or Big Brother, if you're that way inclined.
Or Big Brother, indeed. Both excellent trans representation on both, so it's fine. You choose your poison. As long as Cursed is Queer is going, I will be gladly back here to do Juno Dawson's lovely trans salon, and I hope to see you again this time next year. Thank you and have a good night. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this very special episode of the Brighton Book Club in collaboration with the Cursed is Queer Festival. Really hope to see you at the festival. The lineup is absolutely astounding and a lot of it has now been published on the Cursed is Queer website and tickets are for sale and selling fast. So make sure you get your hands on them. It's going to be a really great way to meet like-minded people in Brighton, and the wonderful team at Kemptown Books will be selling books, so start saving now. If you use the code podcast20 at checkout, you will be able to get 20% off the price of tickets, and you also help to support the Brighton Book Club. Thank you so much for listening.